So good evening and welcome to this annual lecture of the British Society for the History of Philosophy. Before we start, I would really like to thank the Maison Française for allowing us to be here and to support for their support of this event, and in particular Professor Frédéric Stasik-Thibault, who is here with us tonight. It's really wonderful for us to be able to collaborate with the Maison Française in this way. It is also my pleasure to thank Morgan Slayerke, who is the secretary of the society and who has really organized this event. So thank you very much to Morgan for putting us in touch with the Maison Française and for making sure that this was a great success, as we can already see. I am the current chair of the British Society for the History of Philosophy, and the greatest pleasure of all is to welcome back Sarah Hutton, who is one of our former chairs, and indeed the first woman who was a chair of the British Society for the History of Philosophy. So this is one of the many ways in which Sarah has really been groundbreaking in the profession. Another way is to her publications, in particular on women philosophers. So most of you will be very familiar with her 2004 CUP book, monograph on Anna Conway, that was the very first monograph ever on Anna Conway. And she also followed up that with another very important work, which is a British History of Philosophy, the 17th Century, which was published by OUP in 2015.
Yes.
Yeah. In addition to that, she is now editing a special issue of the British Journal for the History of Philosophy on women philosophers. So it is very appropriate for her to be talking today about women philosophy and the history of philosophy. So a very warm welcome to Sarah.
Thank you, Rosa. Now, my voice has a tendency to drop. Can you hear me at the back? If you stop hearing me, can you wave or something so that I will project it a bit better? Well, first of all, I would like to thank the British Society for the History of Philosophy for the honour of giving the annual lecture. I've been associated with the Society for many years and benefited hugely from the opportunities that it has made possible. And it's particularly gratifying that, having been with it so long, that to see how it has developed over the years and is now a flourishing society. My thanks to the Maison Française. It's a pleasure to be back here. I've had occasion to come here for many seminars and workshops in the past, so it feels to be a very familiar environment. And thank you all for coming this evening. Women and philosophy is a fairly topical subject at the moment, but it's sobering to reflect on the fact that it's really only relatively recently that women have really that the climate of receptivity towards women philosophers has changed. It's pretty much within the lifetime of the British Society. So it seems appropriate to, 34 years on from the founding of the Society, to pause for reflection on the changes that have happened in that time with respect to women philosophers. And in what I'm going to talk about today, I propose to celebrate the progress that has been made in recovering women philosophers from oblivion, and to consider the role of the history of philosophy and the doing of history of philosophy in that process. So my comments will largely concern early modern philosophers, European, because that is where I've worked, but I There is now work increasingly being done on women philosophers of all periods, from the Pythagoreans up to the 20th century, and not just in Anglo-America, but also in the rest of the world. So I'd like to think that my remarks are relevant to both other periods and other places. So that's one of my favorite quotes from Damaris Masham, making the claim back in the early 17th century that we should pay more, that women should are just as capable as men to indulge in science. Because by science she meant not science in the modern sense, but intellectual activity. So to begin with a familiar personage, Princess Elizabeth, at least I think she's now familiar among philosophers, Princess Elizabeth of Bohemia, Princess Palatine. In 1643, Descartes received a letter from her in which she queried how, on Descartes' account of soul and body as separate substances, the soul can direct the body in voluntary actions. And so began a philosophical correspondence which lasted until Descartes' death. These letters are the only philosophical writings by Elizabeth to have survived. They were never published. In fact, Elizabeth refused Clercellier's request to include them in his Descartes edition, his edition of Descartes' letters in 1657, and the originals were lost. But some two centuries later, copies surfaced in the library of Rosendale Castle, Arnhem, and were published for the first time by Fouché de Carré in 1879. These copies form the basis of modern editions and translations. In her own lifetime, Elizabeth was famous for her learning and mathematical brilliance. Her philosophical acumen was celebrated by Descartes in prefaces to his writings, but before Fouché de Carré's edition of her letters, her philosophical views were only known through Descartes' replies to her. Elizabeth's fortunes as a philosopher are emblematic of how women have fared in philosophical history. Having endured social restrictions on their practice of philosophy, with few, if any, writings to show for their philosophizing, they came to be regarded as minor figures, if at all, in the history of philosophy. As female philosophers go, Elizabeth was more fortunate than most. Her high birth and breeding ensured she was educated, had access to books, and could even command the attention of philosophers and mathematicians. Of course, we should be careful not to assume that being high-born necessarily was a great advantage. We shouldn't forget that she lived most of her life in exile, and it wasn't enough to save her from subsequently being remembered as a mere learned lady, only interesting because Descartes paid attention to her. Well, happily, all that has changed. Elizabeth is now celebrated for her philosophy. So I'd like to think of, now to reflect on how it is that those changes have come about. And it's worth recalling how, as I said at the beginning, women's contribution to philosophy has come a long way in the last three decades. Until the late 20th century, a great amnesia had set in regarding women philosophers. Their fate in history was, as Eileen O'Neill pointed out in 1998, oblivion. And oblivion is the mother of ignorance. Many feminists of the 1980s admitted to not knowing that there had been any female philosophers, and record their surprise on discovering that there had been. But they quickly found that the fate of women philosophers had been to be treated as at best minor figures in the shadow of canonical male philosophers, if they were lucky, or as learned ladies, such as Marie-Jeanne de Gournay, or they were simply denied intellectual credibility. Margaret Cavendish was dismissed as a mad eccentric, and Anne Conway written off as an hysteric. 30 years ago, almost nobody was working on women philosophers, but there were already stirrings of change. Feminist philosophy had started to make waves. The founding of the feminist journal Hypatia, as the Americans call it, in 1986, signaled a new era. There were increasing numbers working in feminist philosophy, and the first investigations into early modern women philosophers were underway. I might mention, for example, Caroline Merchant's Death of Nature and Mary Ellen Waite's History of Women Philosophers, which she'd embarked on. But then, as now, there was much discussion about the lot of women in philosophy. As regards the history of women philosophers, things began to come together with two landmark conferences, the first of which, I'm happy to say, was sponsored by the British Society for the History of Philosophy. And this was organized by me with Sue James and Jonathan Ray back in the early 90s, 1990s. And a few years later, in 1997, Eileen O'Neill organized the first such conference in North America. It's not an exaggeration to say that these were groundbreaking conferences. It was the first time that people with an interest in the history of women's philosophy had come together. They marked a post-de Beauvoir era insofar as their emphasis on the history of women philosophers represented a move in a different direction from the kind of existential reflection on women's standing in philosophy prevalent in feminist debates at that time. By focusing on women philosophers in history, these conferences shifted the focus of the debate from a negative story of disadvantage to a more positive inquiry into what women had actually achieved in philosophy, highlighting the need for a program of recovering the lost voices of philosophical women. These conferences back in the 1990s were not pushing at an open door. At that time, there was resistance to the idea that there had been any women philosophers, or if there had been, that they were any good. The best hope that a dead female philosopher had for receiving attention was by, as it were, hitching a ride on the coattails of a great philosopher. Damaris Masham, as it were, riding on the coattails of John Locke, or Elizabeth of Bohemia riding on those of Descartes. A link to a more famous male philosopher had its uses, of course, as a way of flagging up a particular woman's interest in philosophy, but it did not disguise the tenuousness of her claims to being considered a philosopher, since she was only considered interesting because of the connection with a great thinker, a great male thinker. Riding on the coattails of canonical figures in this way inevitably consigned her to minor status, diminishing accordingly her claims to be taken seriously as a philosopher. The big change is that these women are now considered philosophers in their own right. So much so that there are cases where non-canonical male philosophers have benefited by association with them. For example, Anne Conway and Mary Astell have given coattail rides to a couple of male philosophers, the Cambridge Platonist Henry Moore and the English Malebranchian John Norris. And even canonical philosophers have benefited by association with women. Descartes, for instance, for long derided as the father of philosophical misogyny, has now got a less negative reputation. Well, of course, these changes did not come about independently of other developments, which were not just in the history of women philosophers. The founding of Hypatia and the Society for Women in Philosophy, together with changes in the history of philosophy itself, have all altered the philosophical climate and contributed to the pressure to recover female philosophers. Of particular importance here were develops in the historiography of philosophy itself. Groundbreaking work of figures like Quentin Skinner, Richard Popkin, and Charles Schmitt, who drew attention to historical context in different ways, of course. Their lead was followed by what used to be called the new historiography, although now it's no longer new. In an essay first published in 1997, Jerome Schneewind argued that for understanding the moral philosophy of the past, we should, I quote, give up thinking of moral philosophy as having some single essential aim and suppose instead that philosophers at different times were trying to solve different problems. And he made the case that historical information and not rational reconstruction of arguments in the best modern terms is the best way to understand the aims and interests of moral philosophers of the past. He reminds us that we should remember the philosophers of the past they meant to be understood by living audiences and not just posterity. And he called attention to the need to look at other kinds of sources, not just treatises on a moral philosophy. And then another milestone on the way was the Cambridge History of 17th Century Philosophy, edited by Dan Garber and Michael Ayres, who were outspoken about the distortions of our view of the history of philosophy that result from a narrow focus on canonical figures. They further charged that philosophers, quote, have lost sight of the complex context in which philosophy was written. Well, these new philosophers were not particularly notable for paying attention to women. In fact, Richard Popkin was one of the takes the prize because he mentions about three or four. There are a few women mentioned in the Garber Ayres edition. Besides, these studies were motivated by assumptions that had their limitations for the study of women. A major one being that the main rationale offered for studying minor figures was that they could shed light on major figures. So while these scholars are commendable for taking a broader view of the history of philosophy, the landscape of major and minor remained unchanged. And within that landscape, women were very much on the side of the minor. Nevertheless, to pay attention to minor figures did give women a look in. And the underlying principle that consulting a wide range of sources can be particularly helpful when recovering women philosophers, because it does who very often didn't write if they wrote published and didn't do so in standard formats. So I would argue that the historically contextualized approach of figures like those I've just mentioned has facilitated the recovery of women philosophers, and this gradually. Names of women, female philosophers found their way into handbooks and works such as the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, and the very, very small articles and cautious word lengths to begin with. This kind of history of philosophy is now beginning to look rather out of date, because more recently there have been some very creative alternatives to the standard models which raise far-reaching questions about the practice of history of philosophy, which challenge us to radically rethink the horizons of historiographical practice. for example, Lily Allen and Charlotte Witt's Feminist Reflections on the History of Philosophy, published in 2004, and the collection edited by Mogens Lerke and Justin Smith and Eric Schliesser on philosophy, its history, aims and methods in history and history in the study of early modern philosophy. And in 2015, the Monist dedicated a special issue to the historiographical and methodological issues for studying women philosophers, and that was edited by Karen Green and Ruth Hagengruber. Such are the concerns for such concerns are of primary interest for the internet-based project New Narratives in the History of Philosophy, led by Lisa Shapiro, Marguerite Delaurier, and Karen Detlefsen. Well, the important point here is that these developments in the historiography of philosophy have changed our view of philosophy and have replaced the reductive and oversimplified accounts of canonical philosophers in the standard narratives with a more complex picture of philosophy. The study of female philosophers has benefited from a fuller and richer understanding of canonical male philosophers, as well as from increased attention to minor figures generally. And this has given more purchase for historians of philosophy in their evaluation of women philosophers. It has also influenced the way feminists think about philosophy itself and how its history has shaped present practice. Particularly important for early modern philosophy has been what might not inappropriately be called the rehabilitation of Descartes, who in the 1980s was held to be the fons et origo of the putative misogyny of philosophy. The richer picture of his philosophy, which brought both his principles of philosophy and passions of the soul into the frame, has helped dispose of the demonized Descartes. And this in turn has helped us to better understand the engagement with Cartesianism to be found among early modern women philosophers, for many of whom Cartesianism was the entry point into philosophy. Now, even with all this work going on, the philosophical writings of women of the past, where they existed, present many challenges. An obvious difficulty is that women did not necessarily present their philosophical views in ways with which we are familiar today. Nor did they necessarily use what are now regarded as standard philosophical terms, nor does their philosophy fit neatly into the categories that have emerged for classifying early modern philosophy and feminist philosophy. Categories such as empiricist, rationalist, and vitalist. Philosophers in the past were usually trying to solve different sets of problems from ours, and different sets of problems even from what we now consider mainstream in the history of philosophy. To get to where we are today in the study of female philosophers of the past, we've had a lot to learn. We've had to learn to take a wider view of the genres in which past philosophers philosophized, to understand the vocabularies they adopted, to recognize that letters can be a philosophical source, to acknowledge the importance of religion in philosophy's history, to understand that philosophers of the past had different priorities and concerns from our own, to work out the issues which they considered important, to pay attention to what they as philosophers intended insofar as we can discern it. This learning curve has involved finding out about so-called minor figures of philosophy with whom the women engaged, considering the circumstances in which philosophers were judged important in their time, and we've had to face the fact that perennial philosophical questions are not as perennial as they might seem, but that the different questions have been considered important at different times. We've had to recognize that the history of philosophy is not a gladiatorial fight to the finish, in which the finish is the survivest of the fittest arguments. We have had to learn not to measure the importance of a philosopher by the number of words he or she wrote. And all these things, of course, apply just as much to the study of male philosophers of the past as to women. Importantly, by reconstructing the context in which women philosophized, and by attempting to address their philosophy in its own terms, we have a better chance of understanding their arguments and analyzing them without sacrificing the otherness of past philosophy. Furthermore, by addressing women's philosophy in its own terms, we shall stand a better chance of determining whether there were in fact problems and solutions particular to women. And an interesting example of this is the recently published book edited by Jackie Broad and Karen Detlefsen, on Women and Liberty, a collection of essays, every single one of which is a take on a different aspect of liberty, freedom, by a different woman. And it is very interesting to see where the focus is in each case. Well, none of these changes would ever have happened without texts. The catch-22 of studying philosophy by women is that they can't be studied without source texts. And until relatively recently, publishers were wary of commissioning texts because no one was studying female philosophers. And recently I learned from Lisa Shapiro that she had a great deal of trouble getting her translation of Elizabeth's letters accepted by a reputable publisher, and until the Chicago series of The Other Voice took it on. There was no internet back in 30 years ago, no Ebo, no Echo, no EMLO, early modern letters online. And I'm very happy to be able to tell you that today saw the launch of Anne Conway on EMLO, and including a couple of letters which are not in Conway letters. So I defy you to go and look and find out which ones they are. Well, the advent of internet resources has helped, of course, and the New Narrative site is one which does this. And so too does... I don't seem to have any narratives here. Oh, Project Vox, yes, Project Vox. And as you know, gradually works by women philosophers have been published. We now have editions of Conway, Astell, Cavendish, and Elizabeth of Bohemia, Catherine Trotter Coben. And these editions have been supplemented by English translations, selections from several philosophers. The Chicago University Press series The Other Voice has published, among others, selections from Gaetana Agnesi, Emily du Châtelet, Tullia d'Aragona, as well as Elizabeth of Bohemia. There are also translations into other European languages. For example, Sabrina Ebersmeyer's German translation of Elizabeth's letters, and Ruth Hagengruber's anthology of texts translated into German, actually as long ago as 1998. And more recently, Sandra Plastina in Italy has founded a series, I Palinesti di Diotima, which includes Italian translations of Catherine Trotter Coben and also editions of Italian women like Camilla Erculani. An English translation of Emily du Châtelet's Institution de Physique is currently being undertaken by a team headed by Catherine Braden. Well, the fruit of all this work is that we have a better understanding of who the women philosophers were, what they wrote, and how they managed to become philosophers, not just why they didn't. Among the many prejudices and false assumptions that have been dispelled is the view that women did not produce any philosophy of significance, that they necessarily must have done so differently from men, that philosophy was misogynistic by definition. I don't mean that philosophy isn't misogynistic, but there was a view, there still is some extent a view that by definition philosophy is much misogynistic. Since the bulk of this work is the fruit of contextualized historical inquiry, I would argue that such an historical approach has proved particularly beneficial for the recovery of these women philosophers. And the evidence for it is the numbers about whom we know now, who were formerly lost to view. And I would even go so far as to claim that a measure of the success of such historical approaches is its greater success in restoring them to visibility than other ways of going about it. In so saying, I should add that it's not my contention that historical approaches are the only appropriate for women, but not for men. On the contrary, historical approaches are important for all philosophers, regardless of gender. My main point is that historical approaches have been successful in recovering women philosophers. Of course, it doesn't mean that women philosophers can only be approached historically. It is, after all, present interests which drive the interest in them. But without historical awareness, we struggle to make sense of them. So I would reiterate the point that historical research is not just is essential for their recovery, but it's also important for enabling them to us to discuss them meaningfully in terms that make sense to us, without diminishing the alterity of past philosophy, either women's philosophy or men's. Being alive to history is not mere antiquarianism, but it has philosophical purpose. It is essential for understanding what philosophers wrote as philosophers. Anne Conway is a case in point. Her text is particularly challenging because of her engagement with unfamiliar philosophies and patterns of thought. Unfamiliar philosophies, Cambridge Platonism, patterns of thought, her use of religious and theological material, including the Jewish Kabbalah, and her sense of the unity of philosophy. So, if I may quote from my own example, the approach which I adopted in my book on Conway was historical and unashamedly contextual. It involved situating Conway among her philosophical peers, but also relating Conway's philosophy, or at least what we have of it, because she's another woman for whom we only have a little bit of what she probably wrote. But I tried to situate her philosophy and connect it to her biographical, cultural, and intellectual circumstances insofar as these could be constructed from her letters, her contacts, and her reading. With a better knowledge of Conway's philosophical formation and the conditions under which she became a philosopher, we can acknowledge her debt to Descartes, and we have a better basis on which to consider her relationship with Leibniz and the grounds of her critique of Hobbes and Spinoza. We can also acknowledge the importance of two hitherto marginalized male figures, Henry Moore and Francis Mercury van Helmont, whose role in her intellectual life was misunderstood. I believe the way is open for a more secure appraisal of her metaphysics in its own right and the philosophical themes on which she focused. And as I said in my book on her, this historical methodology has a philosophical purpose, namely, quote, to enhance our understanding of Anne Conway's philosophy and to give her meaningful philosophical identity. Well, in many respects, the issues of 30 years ago are no longer relevant, or they apply to a lesser degree than they did. The case for the inclusion of women is no longer contested. The work of retrieving philosophical women from obscurity and oblivion is well advanced. Women philosophers are being taught in colleges and universities, and just give you an example. And centers even have their own centers for their own study. This is the German Center for the Study of the History of Women Philosophers in Paderborn in Germany, headed by Ruth Hagengruber. And they run a a summer school on women philosophers every year. So women philosophers are being taught in colleges and universities, and a huge advantage which we have today over the pioneers of the 1980s is that there now is now a pool of cumulative research on which we can draw. We not only know the names of more philosophical women than we did previously, but there is a solid core of philosophical works by some of them, which is now available in modern editions. The skepticism of those who queried whether women philosophers counted as philosophers has in large measure dried up or gone quiet. The combined results of this kind of historical work, which I've described, is forcing reconsideration of the narrative of the history of philosophical history, and with it, the teaching canon. But there are still many unresolved issues. We still face the very real problem of how to integrate women within the purview of philosophical history, how to introduce them into the classroom. And even if the case for the inclusion of women is no longer contested, the answers to these questions is by no means clear. There are lots of things to consider, and perhaps more questions than answers. Should the history of women philosophers be separate from the history of male philosophers? Should they be taught separately? How do we construct a teaching canon for philosophy that include women? Should we, for example, as I believe has been proposed here in Oxford, should we impose quotas on syllabuses? Given the paucity of source materials, is it even possible to construct a canon representative of women philosophers? Well, these are urgent questions, because the pressure to find a genealogy of women philosophers is unrelenting, and a canon of women philosophers is fast emerging. And even with the answers to the questions, I have to say that for an old hand like me, these are very exciting times. We are asking these questions. Everybody's asking these questions now. Women philosophers have been recovered from oblivion, or at least many of them have, and in the fullness of time, then numbers will increase as more of them are studied. But in the fullness of time, too, the victims of the old amnesia, that is, the once forgotten women philosophers, will lose their strangeness as they become more familiar to us, and we adjust our viewing lenses to bring them into focus. This is already happening as Conway, Cavendish, and Du Châtelet find a place in the textbooks and anthologies. Over time, a scholarly literature will develop, and with it, traditions of interpretation and debate. And this too is happening in the case of these women, as a quick glance at the Project of Ox website will show. One of the things it features is syllabuses of courses that people in America particularly have been trying out. But even as we celebrate a new chapter in the history of philosophy, which restores the contribution of women, we need to guard against what I will now call the new amnesia. And by the new amnesia, I mean forgetting how we got to where we are now. Forgetting that women philosophers were ever forgotten. Assuming they were able to pursue philosophy in the same way as we do. Forgetting that putting them back in the frame required abandoning old narratives and old habits of mind that sustain them. The new amnesia brings the danger that integrating female philosophers into the teaching canon, we distort what they said by blending them in. This is more likely to happen if we simply slot women in, howsoever appropriately it seems, into a pre-existing narrative, so that the constitutive areas of what makes philosophy is unchanged. For example, by using women philosophers to illustrate say-mind-body arguments, where once the illustrations might have been taken exclusively from male philosophy. Karen Green and Jacqueline Broad have aptly called this piggybacking on developments of men's ideas. And doing it to, in, to do so is to insert women's philosophy into a narrative originally constructed without them, a narrative which distorted women's contribution principally by excluding them. Such narratives generally endorse and perpetuate wholly presentist views of philosophical history, which were in origin hostile to non-canonical thinkers and are restricted in their chronological scope. Now, it is perfectly legitimate, in my view, to investigate how earlier philosophers treated problems and themes that interest us today. But we must not assume that they necessarily did discuss those things, or that they did so in terms with which we are familiar now. We must not make the mistake of abstracting the philosophical writings of women of the past from their history and treating them as if they were our contemporaries. I don't mean that there were no commonalities between us and them, but the differences defy smoothing them unproblematically into a modern model. To do that is to risk repeating the problems of the past. And the new amnesia is the overlooking of the conditions within which they philosophized. And by that, I don't just mean the very unlevel playing field on which they entered in the first place, but all the consequences that follow from different opportunity. And that also means we should be careful about claims about their influence. The early modern women who became philosophers did so for the most part, the early modern women who became philosophers did so without the theoretical tools which philosophers today take for granted, without the benefit of formal philosophical education, and Anne Conway is an exception in this regard, but she did not actually study in Cambridge, despite what it says on the Cambridge University Philosophy Faculty website. They're very keen to claim her and Damaris Masham, and I quite understand why, but it actually is really a bit of a stretch, that one. Early modern women philosophers, for the most part, did not have easy access to public debate. The most graphic evidence for the differences of philosophical circumstances for early modern women is the fact that there are very few written records of their philosophy, either because they never wrote it down. Sophie of Hanover, Elizabeth's sister, interlocutor of Leibniz, is a great example of that. Either they never wrote it down, or they published very little, or because their writings simply got lost, like Elizabeth's letters. And when they did publish, it was usually anonymously. Cavendish and Du Châtelet are rare exceptions. To compare the only source for Princess Elizabeth's philosophy, her letters to Descartes, with Descartes' Passions of the Soul, is not to compare like with like. How can Lady Conway be put under the same scrutiny as Leibniz when she produced one tiny anonymous treatise as compared with his vast written output? How can we even begin to analyse what she said when we don't have her original text? The Latin is a translation of a lost text, and the English a translation of the Latin. How can we trace influence of any of her arguments when her book was published anonymously? In fact, it's thanks to Leibniz that there is actually a copy with her name on the title page, because he wrote it there on the copy he was given by Van Helmont. But for all that, this doesn't mean that Anne Conway doesn't have anything new or interesting to say. So I shall conclude by suggesting that the best antidote to the new amnesia is the history of philosophy. And in so saying, I'm not making a claim for a single monolithic approach, but for an historically attuned approach, which avoids the pitfalls of older models of philosophical history. I firmly believe that we should accept that the past is a foreign country, in order to hold on to the difference and even the strangeness of past philosophy, and that we should find a way of honing our tools of study to recognize that. We should therefore adopt the kind of approach which has proved so fruitful in the recovery of women philosophers: openness to genre, to different philosophical idioms, to other philosophical priorities, recognition that they did not necessarily use modern analytic modes of philosophizing, and that their work doesn't stand up to modern analytic criticism, not because it's bad philosophy, but because it's different philosophy, produced in different intellectual circumstances. In the recovery of women philosophers, in making them visible, the history of philosophy has played a vital role and continues to play it. And by bringing women philosophers of the past into the present and for the future, the history of philosophy also has a significant role in making women part of the philosophical conversation of the present. A richer history of philosophy, which takes account of the contribution of women, is especially pertinent to the debates about women's involvement in the philosophy profession today. That said, the historical and contextual study of philosophy has its downsides. One objection is that context is just background, which does not impinge on philosophy itself, the business of which is perennial questions and timeless arguments. Well, the study of women philosophers has put paid to assumptions like that, because it has revealed how time-bound the arguments are and how much the questions change. Individual case studies are beginning to show just how connected to females, female circumstances a woman's arguments might be. Another objection to a historical approach is pedagogical. It is not uncommon to hear the complaint that to insist on taking a historical view makes studying women's philosophy difficult, especially for students, by requiring them to study history as well as philosophy. But this is precisely where new approaches to the history of philosophy have made a difference. And thanks to resources like Project Vox, the accumulated knowledge and the richer picture of philosophical history that we have acquired resources such as Project Vox, the accumulated knowledge and richer picture of philosophical history that we acquired can be studied without being burdened by history. On the contrary, the history illuminates the philosophy. The history of philosophy is vital for the purpose of making philosophicals of the past part of a philosophical conversation in the present, for recovering women philosophers of the past in order to bring them into the present and the future. Philosophers today are in the business of framing new narratives for the history of philosophy, which recognize the contribution of women. However, women of the past philosophized in very different conditions from today, and different conditions on the whole from their male contemporaries. To fail to recognize this is to distort history. The challenge for us now is to develop historical narratives and modes of analysis which take account of the limits within which they philosophized, without diminishing their contribution to philosophy. Thank you very much.